Hi, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, June 19th, 1996. The speaker in the Creekside Room this afternoon is Dan Spencer, continuing his series, Ethics and the Earth. Today's session is number 3 and is entitled, The Judeo-Christian Tradition, Stewardship Ethics. Let's listen in.
My name is Dan Spencer. And I'd like to ask right up front, how many folks is this your first time in this session here? So I know how much, we got a lot of, okay, so I want to spend the first few minutes reviewing some of what we've done in the first couple of sessions, not so much that I bore the people who've been here before, but to get us on board a little bit. Just to let you know, I teach in the philosophy and religion department at Drake University in Des Moines, Iowa. And I teach courses in religion and ethics. And one of my greatest areas of ethics is environmental ethics and how we begin to think within our religious traditions and within our culture to begin to confront ethically and morally some of the issues of the environmental situation that faces us. On Monday this week, what we did was begin to introduce the whole notion of what we mean by ecological ethics. And we did that to begin to start to think about our own stories and how we've been shaped to view environmental issues and issues of the land. And I gave a very simple working definition that I'll be using again tonight. Ethicists would develop this much more in detail, but I think it'll work for our purposes. When I'm talking about ethics, this half of the phrase, ecological ethics, I'm talking about the way we reflect together on who we are and how we act in light of some of our values and standards. That is, in light of who we say we want to be and how we think we want to act. So that's the definition we'll be using. Who we are, that's the character side of ethics, sometimes referred to. And how we act, the duties and the principles and the consequences of our actions in light of what our vision is. And for Christians, I think that's particularly important because we work out of a gospel vision that gives us some sense of values, norms, about who we should be and how we should be acting in that sense. Yesterday, what we did was begin to look at some of the spectrum of different approaches to ecological ethics on 3 fundamental questions that help us to ground that. And I'll start there again in a moment here to get us on board with that. What we're going to do tonight is to look at the dominant or the main tradition that's come out of Judaism and Christianity, out of the biblical tradition, and that is what's known as stewardship ethics. And this is important for at least a couple senses. For one thing, Christianity has become somewhat of a whipping post in the current crisis as being one of the main reasons for the environmental crisis. And people have been heavily critical of stewardship ethics as a way to approach environmental issues. So tomorrow we'll be looking at a tradition that's very critical of stewardship ethics. That's the notion of deep ecology. Books both in the library and the bookstore that I want to mention to you before we go in tonight. Let me start with the more general ones. This is a book that I have found just delightful called The Universe Story, From the Primordial Flaring Forth to the Ecozoic Era. And it's co-authored by Brian Swim and Thomas Berry. Brian Swim is a physicist. He comes out of the natural sciences. Thomas Berry is a theologian. He also, along with myself, coins himself as a geologian, and that he takes seriously the earth in his theological ruminations. But what they have done is written in story form the whole history of the cosmos, from the very first being Big Bang, all the way up to the current era here. And I find it very accessible. And if you're interested in just knowing more about what happened 5 billion years ago, 2 billion years ago, 10,000 years ago, in a kind of a narrative form, this is a delightful way to look at that. You might want to even just look at the library copy and read the first introduction, which sets it out in kind of short form. The other book, which I can't promote enough, because it's been one of the 2 or 3 most delightful books of my last several years, is this little book called Ishmael, which is in the bookstore and in the library. How many folks here have read this or familiar with it? Got a few here. It's got a very simple storyline. It's the conversations between a man and a gorilla. And that's basically all it is. But there's a lot that goes on in that conversation. I used this in my environmental ethics class this spring, and when I introduced it to the students and said, this is a conversation between a man and a gorilla, they all kind of rolled their eyes. said, what did Spencer mean this time? Then I couldn't get them to shut up. They started reading it, and it just raises lots of very interesting issues about how we think about the world and what are some of the reigning myths, that is, the sacred assumptions and values we have that we're not even conscious about. It makes delightful reading. It's in the bookstore and in the library. The two books that we'll be looking at tonight, the first by Douglas John Hall, who is very familiar to many people in the Holden community because of his work on the theology of the cross, a Canadian theologian. He has written a book that's a little dated now, but it's still got a lot of good things to say, called The Steward, a Biblical Symbol Come of Age. And I'll be drawing from that to sort of lay out some of the basic parameters of what we talk about as stewardship ethics. And then a more recent book that I'll introduce a little bit tonight on as well is a book called Loving Nature, Ecological Integrity and Christian Responsibility by James Nash, who works in Washington, D.C. On public policy issues and environment and ethics. I think has a wealth of interesting ideas. He takes a somewhat different model than Hall does in stewardship ethics, and we'll begin to look at that. Just again, tomorrow we'll be looking at two other alternatives to this, one called bioregionalism, another called deep ecology. And then on Friday, I'll be showing a short video and discussing a movement called ecofeminism, which combines the movements of ecology and feminism in some very interesting and important ways. Any questions on any of that before we launch into what we're doing tonight?
Did I understand you correctly when you said that Christians are being blamed for the current environmental problem?
Yes.
I thought that's what I heard you say.
And maybe that's a helpful starting point to think about. When the environmental crisis first came to public attention in the late 60s and early 70s of the first Earth Day, philosophers, ethicists, people began to say, now what is it about Western society that has led to this rapid consumeristic kind of culture, all this advance of technology, we're exploiting the earth? And they quickly began to pinpoint, saying that it's come out of the Western society, which has been largely shaped by Judaism and Christianity, especially Christianity. And what their critique was, they said Christianity led to a way of thinking that was very human-centered and ignored the rest of the world, rest of nature, as far as religion goes. And so the earth, in some senses, becomes the passive stage for the great drama of redemption. And when you think about Christian theology and salvation and redemption, very rarely do we think about the rest of nature. That's not true of all of Christianity. But I would say that most of Western Christianity, that has been the dominant sense. So when we talk about salvation of our souls, we're not talking about rabbits. We're not talking about algae. We're talking about human beings. And so that was because some of the critique was that Christianity has made it all too easy to ignore the well-being of the rest of the planet. Very different from, say, Native American traditions or some Eastern religions. Now, I'm going to come back and argue, I think that's too simplistic of a criticism, but I think it has a grain of truth. We brought it up with Dan Erlander's doing a series on baptism, and I asked rather facetiously, why do we never talk about baptism of animals? When I was a child, Martha, my sister here, remember this, we used to baptize our animals and we'd get in trouble because we certainly you weren't supposed to baptize animals. That was sacrilegious. And yet, what I think as kids we intuited was that animals were worthwhile, were beings of worth to us, but there was no room for them in the church. The last thing you ever do is let an animal go into sacred space. Well, Christianity, by and large, has left much of creation out of the sacred drama, and that's been the criticism.
That's very helpful. Thank you.
Okay, does that, yeah.
That paints a very...
And please, if any of you have questions anywhere along the way, bring them up. Yeah.
Is it not true also that Christians have often thought of the earth as something that God gave to us to use, to dominate, to... get what we could out of.
Very much, and what we want to get at tonight, I don't know if you could hear that, but the question was, is it not also that Christianity or Christians have often thought of the earth as something that God gave to us to dominate, to use, to get something out of? Do any of you remember James Watt, the Interior Secretary for President Reagan? One of his famous quotes, when people were raising concern about the rate of deforestation, the rate of forest being cut down, he said, God gave these to us to use. I think Jesus will be disappointed if he comes back and we haven't used up all that we were given. Now, I think that's an extreme form of that theology, but there is that sense that this world was given to us to use. And what we wanted, and he used the term domination. The term in the Bible is dominion, that we've been given dominion over. So we want to ask the question, what does that really mean, and how do we understand that? But certainly, I think there's enough evidence from our culture that we have interpreted as domination. All you have to do is look at the tailings that were left in this file. 20 years of mining is going to leave thousands of years of ecological scarring in this valley. And so we want to begin to ask, are there other ways to think about this? Now, let me give you a very nutshell view about what we did last night in terms of spectrums. And if this isn't clear to you, don't get bogged down. If it's helpful to you, great. We looked at three broad questions about when we think about the environmental crisis, how should we begin to approach it? And one of the first questions is, should we focus on human well-being and the human community? That is, when we think about the problems that we're facing here, many of the problems cause problems for the human community. Dirty water that we can't drink, air that we can't breathe, soil that no longer produces our fields. So there's one whole area that says we should be anthropocentric or human-centered in the way we think about these issues. We need to protect the rainforest because it might have the cure for cancer. Right? That's a form of human-centered or anthropocentric reasoning. There's a whole other branch that says no, that all of life has value, therefore we need to be biocentric or ecocentric. That is, we have to focus on the value of the whole ecological community. All of nature has value. Historically, human beings, when they've done ethics, have seen human beings having intrinsic value. We all have value for our own sake. But everything else was seen as having instrumental value. If it was worth something to us, then it had value. If it wasn't. And you see this in our terms like productive versus non-productive land. Okay? So if it's productive, it's serving human interests. If it's non-productive, it may have all sorts of wonderful creatures on it, but it's not serving our interests. So that's one of the areas. Where should we locate ourselves on that area? And by and large, Western thinking has been largely anthropocentric, human-centered. The second one is a very common debate in ethics in general, but it has a particular form in environmental or ecological ethics. Oh, let me just back up here and say, I'll sometimes use the terms environmental ethics and ecological ethics interchangeably. But in some ways, they really reflect the different parts of the spectrum. If you think about it, the environment is everything that around us that keeps us healthy. That is, we use ourselves as the frame of reference for our environment. So that's more of a human-centered term. Ecological means we fit into a much larger ecosystem. It's a biocentered or ecocentered term. So I tend to use the term ecological. It reflects my own biases here. Second question, should we focus primarily on the moral worth of individuals, that each creature, whether it's human or other creatures, have moral worth as individuals, or should we be focusing on the well-being of the whole community, whether that's the human community or ecosystems? And sometimes you find ferocious debate between these two here. One of the groups if any of you read Alvin Leopold's Sand County Almanac, several years, he fits on what we call the ecological holism side when he develops his land ethic. And Alvin Leopold said the following. He said, a land use decision is right when it tends to preserve the integrity, stability, and beauty of the biotic community, of the whole ecosystem. Notice he didn't say if it satisfies individual needs or desires, but rather if it protects the whole ecosystem. So that's one whole thing. But people, for example, Tom Reagan, who is much more involved in animal rights, has been very critical of this. He sometimes calls this eco-fascism, because strong proponents of this are willing to sacrifice individual needs and individual species for the greater ecological good. And Tom Ring and others say, no, we can protect the overall ecosystem by focusing on protecting individual rights of the creatures within it. So that's one of the debates we'll be looking at further and further as well. And finally, the last one is, how should we approach resolving these issues? Should we work within the system we have? That is, the whole process of reform. That our current system has some problems, but they're changeable, they're reformable. So we don't need to throw the baby out with the bathwater. Or there's a whole other group of folks who say the current system itself is the problem. It's not a question of slowing down the train as it rushes towards the cliff, but rather jumping off the train and taking, a horse or something. So the current system is the problem, and we need a radical transformation of current practices, values, and beliefs. Now, stewardship ethics, I'm going to argue, is somewhere between human-centered and biocentric. That is, the biblical values see all of creation created good, but it quite clearly puts human beings in a unique or central place within that. So it's somewhere along this area here. And I'll also argue it's somewhere along the individual or the holistic thing. It has a holistic concern for all of creation, but not at the cost of the individual value of human beings. And then you can find it, lots of different proponents on the reform versus radical. I would argue if we took it seriously to its real arguments, it would call for a transformation of our current system. But there's a lot of room for it to begin to work where we're located now, within our churches, within our communities. So we'll begin to see some of those things. Questions or comments on any of that before we get started? Yeah.
Well, how does Darwin's theory of survival of the fittest work into all of this stuff?
How do you see it working in?
It's exactly contrary.
Okay, how do you see it working in?
Well, I don't see it working in.
Where do you see the contradiction?
Well, if the survival, if the fittest survive, if a few animals and a few creatures get extinct in the process, so what? They just weren't competent enough to to survive, that's all.
And there are certainly some folks, particularly who would be strongly located here, who would say human beings have emerged naturally as the dominant species. We have all these powers. If other species can't make it, tough for them. There's survival of the fittest. Now, I'd answer it a couple different ways. One is that survival and competition is one aspect of ecology. But increasingly, people are seeing that interdependence and cooperation is a whole other aspect that's been overlooked. That is, virtually all species are dependent for their survival on the well-being of many others. And so we can't survive without the millions of microbes that work in our gut, in our stomach, digesting the food. We can't survive without the oxygen the trees put out. So that there is a great deal of interdependence, and it's very short-sighted to think that we somehow can survive without these other species. So that's part of one way of thinking about it. But the other one is, and this is a very good point that brings up, because the second thing we're talking about here is the ecological crisis. And you bring up a very important point. Species extinction is a natural part of the order. It's been going on for hundreds of millions of years. Species come, do anybody know what the average life of a species is in this earth? Somewhere 4 to 5 million years. If you look at the fossil record, 4 to 5 million years, we're pretty young. We're somewhere around 1 million years old as a species. We may end up being a lot younger extinguished than most are in the record at the rate we're going. What makes it a crisis, however, is the rate of extinction is rapidly increasing due to human efforts. So the natural rate of extinction has been going more or less a common thing. Occasionally you have some catastrophes, a comet crashes into the earth, or you have a big volcanic explosion, something like that. But what's different about the current rate of extinctions is they're human-induced. And that raises all sorts of questions about this planet's ability overall to absorb that. Jeff?
The other really interesting thing is that natural selection is no longer working on the human species. And so we're getting weaker as time goes on.
That would be a whole other issue to look at in that. Although it doesn't seem to be affecting our numbers too much yet.
But that's part of the point is that there are so many people, and I was reading a book review this morning that suggested that the enormous potential of human flesh for some microbe or some animal to go haywire and consume. Because we really are really quite out of control. Yeah.
There's all sorts of things about that, and but just keep in mind one thing: if we were to talk about natural checks and balances, which you're bringing up, survival of the fittest, a statistic that one of my professors has is keep in mind is that at the beginning of this century, there were 1.6 billion people. At the end of this century, reverse that number; there'll be 6.1 billion. So we will have quadrupled the human population. Another way I talk to my students about it, this one just blows me away. There are more people alive currently on the planet than all the rest of the people who've been born and died up to this point. That means if you're familiar with geometric growth, we're in that geometric growth part of the curve. Now the question then, how can our planet sustain not only those kind of human numbers, but how can the rest of the species? Are we simply squeezing out the rest of life? And what we Christians need to ask is, whatever we think about that, is that good stewardship of resources? When we begin to think about that. Well, let me at this point introduce or just outline a little bit what Douglas John Hall says we should be thinking about as Christians about how to do this. I'm a newsprint kind of guy, and I got started because I used to teach in a classroom that had no chalkboard. So I started getting the habit of this, and then I kind of like having these things around. So I have a lot of them here tonight. But the environmental side, I recycle these a lot, so I don't just throw them out. But if you find them helpful, use them. If you find them distracting, ignore them. You also have the advantage of my students. You're not going to be tested on any of this material.
Yes.
Stewardship ethics. Most of us are probably familiar with the idea of a steward comes from the biblical vision, particularly in Genesis 1 and 2. And I'm just going to read the part of Genesis chapter 1 that talks about the sixth day of creation. Many of us forget, and Barbara Rossing had a helpful reminder this morning, that human beings are created the same day as other mammals on the sixth day. So we don't even have our own day. But we're given a special calling within this. So it says, and God said, let the earth bring forth living creatures of every kind, cattle and creeping things and wild animals of the earth of every kind. And it was so. God made the wild animals of the earth of every kind, the cattle of every kind, and everything that creeps upon the ground of every kind. And notice what it says next. And God saw that it was good. Okay, so we start with a recognition of the value, the worthwhileness of creation. Then God said, let us make humankind in our image, according to our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea. This is going to be one of the big questions. What does dominion mean in this biblical vision here? Right? Dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, over the cattle, over the wild animals of the earth, over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth. So God created humankind in his image. In the image of God, they were created. Male and female, God created them. Right? Pretty good so far. God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth and subdue it. Just a little interlude here. Some people say this is the only biblical commandment that we purported of actually obeyed in the whole Bible. We've been very good at filling the earth and subduing it. And have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the air and over every living thing that moves upon the earth. Okay? So this is the whole question here. Then it goes on to talk about subduing, you know, to subdue the earth and have dominion. So what does it mean to subdue and dominion? Is this accurate then in blaming Christianity for the kind of domination and subjugation that's gone on in the earth there? So in Genesis 1 and 2, there are several things that become important for thinking about our relationship to other parts of nature. First of all, throughout this whole story, long before humans enter the picture, every act of creation is recognized as created good. So at the very least, we can recognize that other things have value in God's sight. Okay, that at the very least should break us from being abusive in our relationships to them. But secondly, an important part of this vision is that only humans are set up as being in the image of God. What does this mean to be created in the image of God? And here's where there's been a lot of debate about how do we understand being created in the image of God. And thirdly, human beings are said to have been given dominion. What do we mean by dominion? What's the image here, dominion?
Ruling over.
Ruling over, ruling over. It comes from a royal image oftentimes. But notice that in a royal image, you not only rule over, you have responsibility for. In the ancient image, the ruler not only had rights over the people, he had many duties and responsibilities towards their well-being, part of which was protection and safekeeping. And so dominion has both rights and responsibilities in that image. The biblical image of dominion will develop this even further in terms of what that means. At the very least, we can begin to look at that. Now, what Douglas John Hall argues then, he says there are two things that we need to really be understanding about, for Christians at least. He says that we not only have the Old Testament witness, we have the New Testament witness. And he goes through, I won't reproduce it here, but he goes through several things to argue that Jesus serves finally as our model of faithful stewardship. That just as Jesus was a responsible representative of God to the planet, we should model that kind of thing. And so theologically, Hall argues that's the theology of the cross that should shape our understanding of stewardship. Not lording over, but think about the way God loves the world through Jesus, through acts of solidarity, acts of compassion. Luther's understanding that God, we are closest to experiencing God at the point of the cross. that the cross expresses God's suffering, compassion, solidarity with a suffering and broken world, to the point of dying on the cross, the point of having Jesus under that point. So as we look at ecological crisis here, can we think about that as God being in solidarity with the earth in its travails, in much the way that God is in solidarity with us? That's what Hall is arguing, that the biblical image of dominion is based on ruling over the way God rules over through Jesus. That is an ethic of love, an ethic of self-sacrifice. It's in many points in that sense. So theology of the cross, and that this is an ethic of grace, not an ethics of works, that we earn ourselves into being good stewards, but rather that God's grace, God's graciousness allows us to be faithful stewards, to step away from a domination model, and rather be one of careful, as in the image of carefully tending the garden. So that's some of what Hall is arguing, Nieces argue there. He argues, in fact, that stewardship in many ways is the gospel in miniature. That as we understand the graciousness of the gift of all of life, we respond in gratitude. We can think of stewardship as the same way. That human beings have been given both a vocation of caretaking the earth, as well as responsibilities and the rights that come within that. And therefore, the church should see itself very much as a stewarding community. Now, let me ask you this here. When you hear about Stewardship Sunday in your congregation, what comes to mind?
Money.
Money, all right? We've ended up with what I would call as a very reduced or very reductionistic image of stewardship, as pulling out the checkbook, writing out a check. And what Hall argues, and I think he's really onto something, that is a real distortion. Now, he has a wonderful chapter, and I hope some of you will read this. He says one of the real gifts of the North American church, the churches in the United States and Canada, is that because there was no state church to support them, they had to become self-sustaining. And one of the ways they did that was putting a strong emphasis on stewardship. But the problem was stewardship became associated with money, financial stewardship, which is part of it. But stewardship in terms of the care of a faithful use of resources should be expanded to the whole earth, he's saying. And therefore, we need to see ourselves as stewarding, including not only of financial resources, but all of the earth. He argues then that there are five principles of stewardship. First, he argues is globalization, that we cannot simply look only at our own locale, but must think about, since the whole world is one community, how do we be faithful stewards with respect to the whole world? Secondly, what he talks about is communalization. How do we think about the community aspects of this? Not simply our own individual resources, but how are we stewards in a community, in a communal sense? Thirdly, how do we, what he calls ecologization or ecology thinking, how do we think not only in our human communities, but think of ourselves as part of a much broader natural community in terms of stewarding or protecting that? Fourthly, he says that this ethic has what he calls politicization. That is, it picks up on the prophetic dimension of the biblical witness, that there's clearly many things wrong and oppressive about our world. How do we critique those on behalf of a stewardship understanding? And one that I think is very important too, five, he calls the futurization aspect. That we must constantly keep in mind that whatever we're using up today will not be available for creatures in the future, both human creatures and non-human creatures. So how do we balance current needs with what people in the future and animals in the future and plants in the future are going to need? Now let me just pause here, and that's a fairly quick, very big overview of what Hall is saying we can ground our response to environmental issues through our biblical tradition of stewardship, of faithful, loving care, and responsible use of the creation. What kind of response or questions or thoughts do you have in any of this? Does any of this sound good? Are you critical of it? Whatever. Yeah, we'll start here.
Why do you leave out God's disloyal opposition? It comes in two places. I read Job, first part of Job last night, and it happens to be there. It also happens to be in the first chapter of Genesis.
Okay, tell me more what you mean by this.
Satan.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly, Hall is not ignoring sin. But the interesting thing when you read through, he talks about sin as being when we have slipped from seeing dominion to be domination. When we've slipped from being stewards to being lords and masters. That, and that's, he says, that's against our vocation. So he's calling our vocation to be one of ultimate allegiance to God. And since God has named all of creation good, then we have a responsibility to be caretakers of that creation. When we slip from our allegiance to God, and you can name it as sin, you can name it as Satan, you can name it as mammon like the Bible does, when we have slipped to another ethic of just simply using things for our own self-aggrandizement, that's when we've moved into the area of sin. So certainly, as you were talking, now I don't know if I'm getting to your question here, but the importance of sin being when we ignore what he says is our biblical vocation, to be Christ's representative or God's representatives in a healthy, thriving planet, all in to the glory of God. Does that get at your question, or do you have...
Yeah, okay.
That's a helpful addition. Thanks. Yeah.
For me, I read that universe story. It seemed like it traced like a scientific, more of an empirical view of the world. And sometimes when I hear like a literal interpretation of like Genesis, it almost seems like you get committed to this mythological worldview that really doesn't make sense. So if you make certain assumptions and you... So it almost seems like now we can look at and definitely, at least for me, see Genesis as more mythological or even like things they say about Christ in the New Testament.
Yeah.
So it's sort of like bringing this whole world view, which in some ways doesn't make sense, at least to me. I don't know.
Well, I think you hit a question that's oftentimes very challenging for people. Can we absorb both a scientific understanding of the universe being somewhere around 15 to 18 billion years old, evolutionary period and so forth, with this mythological, and I'm talking about myth here not in the sense of not being true, but myth as a sacred story that expresses the deepest convictions of a community, that creation was created good, that human beings have a special place within that, that God is somehow involved in the workings out of the planet, that sense that we learn from Genesis. But how do we begin to bring those together? And that's, and I, you know, one of the things that's troubling for me, someone, we're gonna, I'll bring up the alternative model, Douglas John Hall's model, which is that he develops a different part of Christian ethics for this. One of the problems I have a little bit with stewardship ethics is precisely that reconciling it with it. If you look at the history of the planet, and our planet's probably, I'm reflecting my geological biases as well here as being trained as a geologist, but geologically speaking, we believe the planet to be about 4.5 billion years old. And if human beings entered in the last million years, what that means is if you were to put the history of the planet on a calendar, human beings appear on the scene about 2 hours before midnight on New Year's Eve at the end of the year. That is, most of the planet's history has happened without us. And of course, most of the planet's life has developed very well without us. And when you look at the ecological crisis, it's mostly from human actions. So does it make sense for us to set ourselves up as the stewards, as the protectors of nature? Or are we rather really the problem rather than the answer to the crisis? One of my concerns sometimes with the stewardship theology, I think there are many wonderful things about it. But it has this sense of nature needing to be taken care of. And we're the ones to do it, appointed by God. In some ways, to me, that seems to be backwards from what's actually happened. Much of the world seems to have gotten along quite well without us. And when we enter the picture is where there are problems coming into place. Yeah?
Do you know much about the translation of that word dominion? If that's a really accurate translation? Someone told me once, I'm not sure this is true, that the word in the original has a sense of gently caressing or shaping. It has a much more gentle, loving tone to it than we would get.
Yeah. Particularly the term subdue, you know, in the Hebrew, in kavash.
Absolutely.
Yeah, well, I think we've taken that one and said that means we have to do everything and just plow.
Yeah.
And that one does have a sense of there being some striving in there. But it isn't the kind of sense that we have of like enslaving, you know, subduing and so forth. But I think dominion, it does follow, and this is much, you'll see much of this in the Old Testament. We'll take the notions of relationships from the reigning political order, which was a monarchy. So you have a kingdom, and a king has responsibility for it. You can have a benevolent king, you can have a dictator, but still the king has dominion over his subjects. And that's still kind of the image here. although the subjects don't belong to us, that's where the steward comes in. A steward takes care of something on behalf of someone else. Does anybody know the etymology of the word steward in English, at least?
It's a person that serves a king, actually. It's a mm-hmm. person that's a servant to the king.
Servant to the king, so rules on behalf of. So the allegiance is always to someone greater than yourself. But what is this? There's a wonderfully humbling sense when you understand the English, where it comes from in Old English. Michael, are you familiar with this? Or anybody know? Dan? Did I tell you already? The Sty Warden. The keeper of the pigs. This was the guy who was out there mucking up the pig manure and keeping the pigs on behalf of the Lord somewhere. It wasn't a very glorified job originally, all right? But you had an allegiance to someone else before you. And so if we can keep that sense in there, that's part of being stewarding is not for our own glory, our own good, but on behalf of, we're accountable to someone else who has pronounced it as being good, as having value. That can be important. Yeah.
How solid are these numbers that you throw out in the realm of time? I just heard the other day that time means different things in different parts of the universe. Like in a black hole, there is no time. Yeah. And as you get out farther, where it's going, things are going faster, while there's time goes faster.
And that's a very good point. I mean, these are estimates, which I think we should use to give us some sense of scale, but not get too locked into the numbers themselves. Frankly, I can't even compute what the number 1 billion means. I know it's really big, but beyond that, it doesn't have a lot of sense. I mean, the scale, the fact that a billion is 1 million millions, and I have a hard time understanding what a million is. But what I think is really important is that up until, it's only been in the last century that human beings, at least in the West, have understood that we haven't been around for the majority of time, history. Most human beings in the West until the last century thought that the Earth was maybe 4,000, maybe 6,000 years old, and human beings have been here since the beginning. So that gives you one whole sense. In that kind of understanding of the Earth, a stewardship relationship makes a lot of sense. If we've been around from the beginning and we have all this possibility and power, we better exercise it responsibly. And I think for me, that's the best, the most powerful thing about this stewardship thing. It recognizes for better or for worse, we may wish it were different, but for better or for worse, we have all this power. So what do we do with it? How do we exercise it responsibly? And if we are accountable to someone else much greater than us who has proclaimed it all good, then we better tread carefully. That's, I think, a wonderful part of that image. Yeah.
Dan, just a question on another way to interpret stewardship.
Mm-hmm.
One way to think of stewardship is you're saying out towards the rest of the creatures that we were all created on the same day. Maybe stewardship might be better thought of being stewards of our participation in that creation.
Well, that's a wonderful way of thinking about it, too. And I'm going to repeat that for the tape here so I pick it up. Rethinking stewardship, not so much as expressed outward, but would you say again what you're talking about in terms of stewarding our own?
Our participation in the whole.
Our own participation in the whole. And that's what, that'll help me. That'll be a wonderful segue into exactly where I want to go, because James Nash, I think, has a wonderful sense of dominion in this same sense, stewardship here. He says this. He says, the reality suggests that dominion has narrow implications. It is primarily the protection of the planet and its inhabitants by humans against human exploitation. That is, stewardship and dominion should be self-limitation in the human community so that the rest of the earth may thrive. And so in that sense, we steward our efforts, we steward our resources in appropriate ways that limit our tendency to absorb everything for our own use. And this, yeah, Gertrude.
Well, I talked to you before about right in the beginning of creation, God rested on the seventh day, asked us to do the same. And so I took the seventh seriously and tried to do a study of it. Why the seventh? If we all did that, I mean, that's part of the creation story. Mm-hmm. If we all did that, we wouldn't have a lot of these problems, because the earth itself replenishes itself in 7 years, even if we don't, if we've abused it. Animals, wild animals, eat 6 days, rest, don't eat the seventh day. We've changed that because we feed them and tame them and so forth. We sort of mess it up in that, not taking that order seriously. We need a sabbatical ourselves. Mm-hmm. So this is why you have a Jubilee year. You're supposed to rest on the seventh day. You rest 7 hours, work 7 hours, you get a rest 1 hour. You take it daily to mean something to you. So in the whole, that we really mess it up from the beginning, not taking that kind of gift he's given us to rest, for the earth to rest, And I argued at the time, why don't people have, we have seven jobs and eight people are employed. Okay, one person gets to take off, there's always somebody replacing you. The next year, another person. You can always go back to your job, but you've had a year off to do something completely different or rest. Mm-hmm. And I think it would do something economically, it would do something socially, spiritually.
Yeah.
If we really did that kind of thinking on the whole.
And you know, there are some ways, you say there are wonderful things in our biblical tradition can help us to reclaim that.
Right.
When we were doing our environmental autobiographies on Monday, it was really interesting to me because I asked people to talk about what came out in common. What was the point that came out in common as you talked to each other? And remember what the very first point was? A work ethic. We all grew up with a work ethic. You have to be productive. You have to make things produce. And we've been enormously successful as a culture with that.
Well, yeah,
rest, renewal.
You think, let it rest a year for
yeah. And that's the part we haven't seen. And we're beginning to see that ecologically, in terms of long-term ability, that's problematic. Let me talk a little bit about Douglas John Hall's approach, because he uses a somewhat different way of thinking about how to look at these issues. Hall raises some, not Douglas John Hall, James Nash. Nash raises some of the questions that I do. His concern with a stewardship ethic is, even though we're thinking theologically, it still tends to be fairly anthropocentered, because it puts all the attention on what human beings are doing to take care of nature. And he thinks there are other ways to emphasize the relationality that serve better. He says the key to Christian ethics, that theologically and ethically Christianity is always centered around love, and particularly neighbor love. We're to love our neighbor as ourselves. And so what Nash asks and says, what does that mean in an ecological context? We've had 2,000 years to think about, what does that mean in the human community? How do we love our neighbor as ourselves? We have the Good Samaritan story, these things. But how do we extend this to an ecological context? And so what Nash does in his book is he follows an approach that's called moral extensionism, or ecological extension, where you take the values and the norms and the principles that have evolved in our human community and think about, what would this look like in an ecological framework? What would it mean to love not only other human beings, but to love nature? The title is targeted there. And so his approach is to rework Christian ethical principles in light of this. And he's got some very creative things, but I just put up here some examples here. Anybody here that was in the biomedical ethics series last week? I don't know if we have any, got just a couple there. We were working a lot with ethical principles like respect for life, like beneficence, like non-maleficence, ones you'll hear about sometimes. Well, Nash takes those same principles and reworks them in an ecological framework. So respect for life in biomedical ethics means that another human being has intrinsic value. You always start there respecting that, so you don't kill someone intentionally, those kind of things. What about respect for life in an ecological framework? Nash says we need to rethink this, and he says to recognize intrinsic value in all forms of life, either as equal value. All forms of life have equal intrinsic value, and that would be the end point here on biocentrism. Now, Nash doesn't follow that himself, because he says that's not true to a biblical vision. He says, or a graded scale, that all life has value, but some life has more value, including human life having the greatest value in that sense. Whales having more value than mosquitoes, this kind of thing, that you can make distinctions, but recognize that all has life. So respect for life now is thought through ecologically, not just in terms of human beings. Non-maleficence. In biomedical ethics, this is the duty for physicians to do no harm to their patients. Nash says we need to rethink this about preventing or minimizing harm to our neighbors. This is a part of the Christian ethic, thought of now as both our human neighbors, but also other kind, what he terms as all of life. How can we minimize harm to the rest of life? Beneficence. Beneficence is usually thought of as the duty to do good to others, the duty to promote the whole well-being. Nash says not only in terms of our individuals, but how about promoting the whole well-being of ecosystems, of habitats, of species? That is, thinking consciously about how do we make sure we have healthy well-being of thinking ecologically. A very important one in Nash's ethic, when he's focusing on neighbor love, is he says we can never separate social justice from ecological justice. And so when we're working out these issues, the burden can't fall unfairly on the side of the poor. Now let me give you just one very quick kind of example. How many folks are familiar with the problem of the ozone layer? All right. What's causing that problem? What has caused that problem of the ozone layer?
Fluorocarbons.
Carbon dioxide does more of the global warming, but in terms of the ozone layer, fluorocarbons kind of thing. Now, what do? Where do we use them?
Refrigerators.
All right. Refrigerators a lot. Now.
Oh, there you're wrong there. They're using all kinds of cleaning fluids.
They're using solvents as well. They're using cleaning fluids.
Going bad, used to have barrels and barrels of that stuff around.
Yep. And increasingly, we're phasing them out. But here's the situation. If we simply freeze the current use of it, who has access to those?
Government.
Well, think globally.
Refrigerator.
Where do you find refrigerators and where don't you find refrigerators around the world? All right, the two-thirds world of the developing countries, by and large, haven't even gotten to the point of having access to refrigeration. If we simply freeze our situation now, we give undue burden to the poor nations. They'll never be able to reach our point here. So Nash's point is that we can't, when we think through ecological solutions, we have to keep in mind social justice as well as environmental well-being. And we can't have problems that simply hit the poor harder than the rest of us. He also says we need to think about the responsibility to future generations. That's much the same as Paul did, but that now he's talking specifically about not only future human generations, but other future generations of other plants and animals as well. So think about those specifically. Some of these kinds of things here. So Nash is taking a different aspect of the Christian ethic, that is to love your neighbor as yourself, and saying, what would that look like if we included trees, plants, animals, as part of our understanding of neighbor? As part of that, and particularly when you think about it in the New Testament model, oftentimes the neighbor is the neighbor in need. Think of the Good Samaritan story. Who proved neighbor to the man who fell above thieves? Well, it was the Samaritan in that sense. So either the one who's most unpopular, the one who's in need. Now, I think there's some other things we could talk about there, but why don't we just take, we've got about 10 or 15 minutes left here. What are some of your thoughts about these ways of thinking about approaching environmental issues as a grounding? Yeah.
I have a similar kind of problem that raises its head in this discussion as it did in another one this morning, and that is a sort of a hierarchical overview of this. Even the neighbor love has the tenor of mercy as opposed to compassion. Mm. It's an objectification of other rather than an understanding of a commonality, mm-hmm. of a continuum of life. And I struggle a lot with the attitude that I'm going to be merciful and live a more gracious ecological, mm-hmm. ethic. And I think that we're being called to think about that differently. To understand other life from a more subjective, framework.
But a couple of things here. It's a wonderful comment, and I want to respond in a couple of ways. The questions you're raising are very much the questions we'll deal with tomorrow and Friday, because they're the critiques of these models here. They say these models start us on the right way, but they don't go far enough. And I didn't talk about this too much earlier, but what I have drawn here is what Jim Martin Schramm, my colleague, calls the leap to environmental ethics or ecological ethics. And we've been talking mostly up in this early, the surface level here, some of these things. Deep ecology says you haven't taken it deep enough. We have to critique hierarchy itself. We have to critique making gradations in value itself. The problem is human-centeredness, and human beings putting themselves at the top of the hierarchy. That's the problem. If we don't start there, all the rest of this won't matter at all. Ecofeminism, which we'll talk about on Friday, takes it even another step and says it's not only human-centeredness, it's male-centeredness. Not all parts of the human community have benefited from this centeredness. But those who are male, those who are white, those who are wealthy, I mean, there are certain portions. And therefore, ecofeminism says unless we critique patriarchal relations, we can't resolve environmental issues. So we have to keep taking it deeper and more deeply. But the other one, that what Nash and Hall would come back to say, and I think they've got some point there, they say you're right in the sense that hierarchy is dangerous. On the other hand, as far as we know, human beings are the only creatures that have a lot of self-conscious moral agency. By moral agency, I mean the ability to make choices in light of values. There's some evidence that there are other, you know, dolphins and some other communities may do this. But by and large, most other forms of life operate through instinct, through other things. They're not making consciously moral choices about it.
By our definition.
There's the point, you know, how do we know? How do we know?
We aren't willing to let go of the predilections we have for understanding. Part of what ecofeminism, I'm sure you'll get into, is to get into the idea of knowing something in a different way, having different information.
When we did these spectrums last night, I'll just read to you one of the things, because it comes to this point here. One of the last ones on this question of anthropocentrism versus biocentrism, ecocentrism. The last biocentric one said, I agree with you that human beings have some outstanding abilities that are superior to those of other animals, but other animals also have abilities far superior to ours, such as flying or the hearing abilities of whales. Isn't it convenient and a bit self-serving that we choose the qualities that we do best and construct a hierarchy of values that places us at the top? But it's just this tendency towards hierarchical thinking that gets us into problems in the first place. Mm-hmm. And that's very much going to be the positions we'll look at tomorrow and on Thursday. And I think is a very valid critique to make of these approaches here. But this, by for better or for worse, and this is what we need to think about, this is our Judeo-Christian tradition that has both a healthy respect and humility in the face of God, but also gives human beings a special vocation within this as being created in the image of God. We have to wrestle with that. Michael?
Yeah, just to respond, I mean, I know the problematics surrounding hierarchy, but if we work with your definition of ethics, then that reflection on who we are and how we act, if we put the ethical question in terms of a how we act kind of concern, and that is making choices, that is at times prioritizing, and whenever we prioritize, we are, at least in a utilitarian way, working with a hierarchy. Mm-hmm. And I think in that sense, hierarchies in that respect, they're inescapable if we make decisions in terms of choice and priority.
And what
different than constructing the way you see the world in creation in a hierarchical model, which is what?
Well, no, because if we have a close connection between who we are and how we act, that relationship between our action and understanding of ourselves is the way in which we construct our world.
If we make, for example, a choice that compassion is more important than efficiency, then you have prioritized compassion in place of efficiency.
Yes.
The danger, I think, happens when we take hierarchical models and transfer them to valuations in nature. And part of our Western heritage, both from the Greco-Roman values and from Christianity, has what often has been called the great chain of being, where you start with God at the top, angels, man, woman, child, slave, animal, plants, rock. I mean, it has been a hierarchical ordering. And that was one way that societies made decisions about how to treat each other, how to put things in the place there. The question for us is, one, is that an adequate way for us to think about it? And secondly, is our tradition reformable? This gets to that whole question, is the tradition that we have from the biblical basis reformable ways we need it, or do we need a new way of thinking about that? Those who say it's reformable are still, by and large, in the church and the synagogue. Those who say not are elsewhere. But that's the debate I think we have to wrestle with. And part of what I appreciate about Paul and Nash is they make sure that I don't jump boat too quickly. That is, I don't have time to go into it, but there's some wonderful examples in there about helpful ways to rethink this from within our own tradition that I think would be wonderful for churches and synagogues to wrestle with in terms of thinking about these issues. I think our biggest problem is not so much that we're all ready to jump ship, but most people don't even realize the ship's in trouble. Most of our churches haven't even begun to grapple with the fact that there's an environmental crisis or the fact that our biblical tradition may have something positive to say about it. We're still, I think, in most of us, operating out of a redemption drama that uses the world as a stage to jump to heaven. Mm-hmm. And literally the world be damned. I think that's a distortion of our biblical heritage, and these two writers, as well as others, are helping us to recover the positive sides of that. And let's see, we've got 3 or 4 minutes, I guess. I don't want to hold you late here.
I've been liking a lot of the things that I've seen out of physical science in the last 20 years that more or less take the idea that we must be in a dialogue with the things we examine, that we have formerly tended to think of as not capable of speaking to us, rocks or whatever, that if we can develop an idea of a conversation with the things we're examining, including, you know, the stuff they're talking about with we don't just look at electronics with wonderful, sophisticated equipment. We actually are in some kind of an interaction.
You can't observe it without actually changing what's being observed, yeah.
And so we need to tune in and listen to what's being said to us.
There are some wonderful ways to do this. Dan, I could say, one of the ones that I'm not actually going to talk too much about in this time, but there's a whole field called process thinking, which gets us away from more of the mechanical thinking that the world is a bunch of billiard balls bumping into each other, and says actually the world is a bunch of interconnected processes in which we participate, and that it constantly focuses on the interrelatedness, and theologically that it sees the Spirit of God is infused throughout creation. So that when we damage any part of creation, we are damaging the Spirit of God, the breath of God that infuses all creation. Part of what's been hard for Christianity in this sense is that Christianity has been very afraid of pantheism, that is equating God with creation, of melding them together. So it has a very strong creator, created, don't mix the two. On the other hand, Christianity all has is the incarnation, the God became, took on flesh. And what Hall and Nash are saying is not only human flesh, but took on the aspects of the world, in that sense. So it's in solidarity not only with the human community, but all of the world. So I think there are ways for us to think about these issues. Dan?
One argument I've read that the crisis is so severe that we have to try to solve it with the symbol system that the majority of North Americans have. The dream of turning most of this nation into deep ecologists or ecofeminists, that people have the symbol system of the Bible, and that's where we need to. What do you think of
it? Well, that's one of the reasons most of the reason I stay Christian is because I still, for better or worse, believe most of it. But I think one of the other reasons is this is our heritage. This is the way we talk to each other. This is the way, I don't think most of us has any sense about how deeply ingrained into our subconscious these ways of thinking and viewing the world are. So we're not going to all simply turn Buddhist or Native American or whatever it is. Now, for people for whom those systems speak, I think it's a wonderful way, and I think we have much to learn from them. But I also think this was the point, that some of you may have read Matthew Fox and some of the focus on creation, spirituality, creation theology, that we don't have to leave our tradition to find these riches, that there are lots of these within them. The Orthodox tradition, for example, is very clear that redemption involves all of creation, that all of creation is groaning and waiting for the glory of God, and therefore, it isn't simply going to be a blast off into some rapture that we leave behind the planet in blown up nuclear ruins. We're all involved in that. So I agree, Dan. I think that this is our value system. It makes much more sense in that sense, particularly the time frame we have to work within that. Well, on Friday I'll be talking about a writer, Rosemary Ruther, who's written a book on ecofeminism, and she makes that point. She says there are over 1 billion Christians on Earth. We need to have ways to talk about these issues that make sense to us, that tap into our most deep, our deeply held values. On the other hand, I think it's really important to hear the critiques and the questions that others are raising so we can examine ourselves more deeply in that sense. And that's what we'll be doing a little bit tomorrow when we look at bioregionalism and the deep ecology. Just one little question on that is, one of the things I think that's been hard is one of the main metaphors for the Christian faith is a pilgrimage. We're on our way. We're leaving this world behind. We're moving someplace else. If you're ultimately concerned about where you're living, it's hard to do that if you're always moving someplace else. Bioregionalism tomorrow will say the opposite needs to happen. We need to adapt our religious beliefs, our culture, to where we're located and put them in sync with the natural rhythms there. And so we'll look at that in deep ecology. And then on Friday, look at ecofeminism, which I think is in some ways some of the most exciting things that are going on. But thanks very much for coming on such a beautiful evening. And I hope, just make sure whatever you do, if this is too weird, just enjoy the mountains when you're here, the rushing rivers.